Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for people who play with needles. And this is the midweek version of that. And Christine's back. Yay.
Yes. Very happy to be so, because otherwise I would be doing something work-related, which I would not be happy to be doing.
No. No.
Well, let me take that back. Not that I would be happy, but I'd much rather be sitting here stitching and talking about stitching than doing something work-related. How's that?
Nice tap dance. Very well done.
No, because I do enjoy my work. That's true. But I also enjoy coming home and doing some stitching. So.
Okay. Noted.
I have to say, I've been giving a lot of thought to, as I completely go away from the list of things we said we were going to talk about.
Not the first time that's happened, so it's all right.
Yeah. So I was reading Mary Corbett's blog the other day, and I don't know, I'll be completely honest, I don't know if it was a current thing or if it was something that I just ended up going down the Mary Corbett rabbit hole of learning things that I usually do. But something came up about hand lotion. And there was another question on Facebook where somebody was asking about hand lotion as well, especially because it's wintertime and people want to, you know, everybody's hands get kind of dry in the winter. And it's funny because I don't notice that my hands are uncomfortable at any time other than when I start doing needlework. And then all of a sudden, my hands feel dry and uncomfortable. So I started thinking about, you know, what would I use on my hands? And so that was sort of the gist of what was going on. And Mary had said that Swatelger had marketed their own hand lotion for a while, but I don't know if it's available. And there's another maybe very small sort of Stitchers hand lotion. And other people are recommending different things and, you know, things they like that are good for hands. But then other people are saying, you know, they don't want it to rub off on their needlework because, you know, they don't want it to leave marks or greasiness or anything like that. So the reason I brought this up was because this is what I do for a living, is make things like that. So I've been on my commutes, which are lengthy, spending a bit of time thinking about what would make a good hand lotion for a needle worker. And I think that it would be different for what you're working on. So when I notice when I'm working on a crewel project that is wool, or if I'm knitting with wool, something like that, wool just sucks the moisture out of your hands. It just does, right? Because it, normally when wool is still attached to its sheep, it's full of lanolin, which is a really nice, it's actually a really nice ingredient to use in lotions and things like that. So if I was making something with, for somebody that was doing crewel or knitting with wool, I would use a lot of lanolin in it because it would A, do only good things for the yarn that you're using, and B, it would be really comfortable. It's an excellent ingredient. But for something like silks, where you're using a silk fabric or something like that, I think I would go with something silicone-based because it tends to just kind of evaporate off and not leave a residue, and it leaves your hands moisturized but sort of with a powdery feel and not a greasy feel. So I had this whole conversation in my head. Like,
So now then, we have a line. We have a line of lotions depending on.
I kind of think that I might actually do that because I think that it really depends, because I think that it would different lotions would serve different purposes, because if you're working with wool, you would want something that's going to last on your hands a little bit longer because it's just going to get sucked into the wool and it won't hurt the wool. If anything, it'll benefit it a little bit. But if you're working on something with fine silks, you want something that's going to stay on your hands and not rub off. And it's just going to give your hands a beautiful, silky, powdery finish. So, yeah. And of course, the main thing that you want two things. You want your hands to be comfortable, but you also don't want to ruin the needlework that you're working on. So,
right.
So I have to give this some thought, and I might actually do that as a little weekend project, is to make a couple of lotions at home and sort of experiment with them and see if it actually makes a difference one over the other, depending on which type of fiber you're working with.
So there's potential then that Vanna will have to give up some of the space on her aisle at Joann's for your line of lotions.
Yes, it's possible. Next to the homemade thread liquor.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can come up with anything that would be named anything better than that, though.
Well,
truly.
I'll tell you what, partner with Vanna, she'll come up with something that would name
That
it.
Is true. That is true.
She'll come up with something, some five-word name she'll do that for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, and the thing is, I have some really good, you know, so I make lotions for work, we do all very natural ingredients. So there's a very small toolbox of things that I can use. And then when I was getting tattoos, and I have friends who have tattoos, I made completely different things. Or friends who had babies who had really bad diaper rashes, I made completely different things for them that I had, you know, could use a little bit different ingredients. So for this, I would branch out a little bit and use different sorts of ingredients. So I'm used to sort of making other things that are a little bit outside of my work sort of wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And doing them at home, and basically I can do them with home equipment, not industrial equipment, which is nice. So I might try that.
Well, that's fun. That's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a lot of it is, you know, it's beeswax and lanolin, like I said, you know, it's a lot of, you know, pretty simple, straightforward things. But it's a common thing, you know, your hands just get uncomfortable. If your hands are uncomfortable, especially if you're sitting under a light, the light's a little bit warm, it just makes your hands feel worse, and you've got all these fibers dragging against it, sucking the moisture out of your hands. It's unpleasant.
Right.
So for all the people, and I know a lot of people had a lot of really good suggestions, and quite frankly, they were excellent. The CeraVe lotion's really, really good. Aquaphor is excellent, but it might leave a little bit of a residue because it's got a lot of petrolatum in it. So, it was an interesting thing to read. So, anyway.
Yep.
Cornhuskers
for me. That's the one. I just have used that for years.
Yes. Yes. There's tons of really, really good things out there for sure.
And I forget what one Mary uses. Mary has one that she uses exclusive, but I don't remember what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, that thread gets hauled out about every winter. Her article about hand, because yeah, it is a real problem. And I notice it with silks because my hands start snagging the silk. And
yes,
you know, that's never good. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And it makes a difference if your hands, but again, you don't want your hands to be greasy because then that's not helping. But on the other hand, you know, and this comes back to the conversation we had with Vanna, where she was talking about wetting the thread a little bit. If your hands are, you know, not lotiony, like greasy lotiony, but if your hands have a little bit of, you know, tack to them, if you just run your hands through your thread, that could actually be a benefit, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that could be kind of a nice thing. So I'm going to have to do some experiments.
So we'll look for the line of lotions coming up. All right. Yes.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of interesting because I think there is merit to the idea of doing different types of lotions for different types of fibers.
Yeah.
I mean, it
makes some sense, especially when you talk about wools and have using lanolin for wools. I mean, that's just a natural combination. So that's.
Right.
That makes perfect sense. Yes.
And just because wool just really, it's just brutal on your hands. So you can stand to, you know, have something that's got a little bit more heft to it on your hands because it's just going to be worn off into your fiber, and that's okay. Right.
Right. Right.
So, but then some of the finer fibers, you wouldn't want that. So you'd have to do something maybe a little bit more silicone based. So anyway, We'll see what happens.
Okay, well, obviously a memo has to go to Vanna so that when she's working in her bat cave, she works on some names. So we'll come up with that.
Yes, definitely.
Yes. Yep. Was in St. Louis this weekend, seeing the daughter, son-in-law, but mainly seeing the grandkids, because, you know, that's how it goes. And I had an idea. You have a lot of ideas on a 5.5-hour car drive to St. Louis from Chicago. That I would see if I could get into the Sign of the Arrow shop and do a little video interview. And so Gene, who is the, there's two managers. Anyway, she's one of them, was kind enough to give me a half hour. And we did a video interview with her to talk about the Sign of the Arrow, because the Sign of the Arrow is unique in that there are two paid employees, and everyone else is volunteer. And it started long ago by a sorority as a left over from a fundraising effort. And I won't spoil the whole story because I did do the video and tell the story. But the cool thing is a portion of their profits has always gone to local charities. And I think I think in the years they've been around, $3.7 million, if I have that right.
Wow.
Of profit that has gone to local charities, battered women, you know, people, you know, women who are out of a house and have a child, but all kinds of charities, not just that kind, but all kinds of charities. And so this is the ongoing thing. So it's very different from your standard needlepoint shop. And it's primarily, it's all, for the most part, all painted canvas. And then, and then a portion, about a third or so of the store, is gifts. So, you know, pretty plates and bowls and other things. And it's a unique store and with that unique business model, and then all volunteers working. And it's been there a long time. So she was kind enough. So we got to do a little interview, and they do an annual ornament. Every year there's an ornament since 72.
Wow.
They do it every year, and you can still get all of them. A lot of them are still in chart form, but now they offer them in chart or as a painted canvas, and they do one every year. And so we got to talk about those and see those. And then, of course, they have threads to burn. And she said they have one of the largest needlepoint belt collections. It sounded like for anywhere around, and it was a whole rack of them. So it was a lot of fun to talk to her and do a little video tour of the shop. And that'll be available. There'll be a link for this podcast, or if you're one of our FlossTube YouTube subscribers, then you'll get it automatically. But it was a lot of fun to do that and just tour the shop. And it's just a unique business model, and I really just wanted to promote it because of that. So a lot of fun.
Yeah, that is nice. That is really good, and I like the idea of doing it as a volunteer activity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I don't know how they coordinate that, because they have people who are responsible for threads and different kinds of canvases and stuff. So it must be an interesting structure for how they keep from having the store completely flooded with canvases. But and this was Friday afternoon, and there were several people in and out of there while we were doing it. So it's not like they're sitting around watching paint dry. They stay pretty busy. And I've been in there on Saturdays when they're just full of people. So it's just a neat thing right there in St. Louis. Wasn't too far from our daughter's house. So I just ran over, and it was a fun video to do. So, yep.
Cool.
Good for them. So that'll be available. We'll put a link up. And like I said, on our YouTube, if you're a subscriber there. Fun thing. Thank you once again to Nicola for filling in last week.
Yes, thank you.
What a fine conversation we had there, and talking about reproduction samplers, which it seems like every time you talk about them, there's more to learn, which is kind of neat in its own right. And then the five samplers, mine are ordered, the five samplers that Hands Across the Sea Samplers is introducing at the Nashville show. Mine are ordered. I'm just going to collect them. I don't know if I'll stitch all of them or one or two, but I'm going to collect them anyway because I like all of them. So, yeah. So that's, and then the Nashville show, which is March 2 to 4, then Christine Wood and I will be at that show. And
yes.
We're going to do podcasts, and we'll go around as much as we can to the various designer rooms, because it's an Embassy Suites and it's a cash and carry thing. So each has their room, and then they set up their all their offerings in the front of their suite, and you just go from one to the other. And so we're going to tour, go around and tour and meet them and see what they have new to offer. And do videos of that. So we'll have podcasts at least two of the days, if not three, and then we'll have videos that we'll put out in the weeks to follow, so you can see what people had new, as many of them as we can get in. But I'm really looking forward to that. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I am too. It'll be nice to sort of get out, because we've been doing this for a while now, and we know a lot of people, but we haven't met a lot of people. So I think this is going to be a really nice opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I do too. I'm really looking forward to it. And yeah, you mentioned it was about a week ago from today that we started. So we have a year in already.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that, but you're right. Yeah, a year. Wow.
1 year.
Hard to believe. A year, and we've done 50, 80... Yeah, we've done 90-plus podcasts in a year.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so I didn't even think about that. So, yay, you know, happy whatever birthday for us, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd sing, but then that would ruin the podcast. And
You know, in our old podcast, we always used to joke that for anniversaries like this, we would have like a bell or something. And then the joke became that we just had the most anemic bell ever. It was like the bell that you would have at the saddest county clerk office, you know, at the counter.
Well, actually, if you'll give me just a second.
You have the bell. our anemic bell.
We can bring back the past. There it is, right there.
Oh, there we go.
There it is. There's the magic bell for celebrations. yeah. And yes, lame, anemic, and pathetic. Yes, all those things.
Mm-hmm. It's our celebration bell.
Yep. And that's all you're going to get for a celebration out of us, right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's pretty much it. Because, yep. Yeah. So, yeah, a year. That's hard to believe. And and actually, I was looking at numbers today. And this month, January, will be our biggest month of activity between the YouTube videos, the FlossTube videos, and website activity, and all of the podcast apps. So thanks to everybody for listening, because that's, we keep growing every month, and it's really great. So, yay. Two things that I learned. We talked with Vonna about the Snag Nabbit.
Yes, we did.
Okay, so I went to Joanne's and conjured up enough courage to utter the words Snag Nabbit to a retail person. But that was after looking for 10 minutes. I had no luck, because it was not anywhere near where it logically should have been. But okay. So there was a lady doing some kind of an inventory, and I just went up and just quietly asked if they had Snag Nabbits in the shop. And she didn't even flinch. She said, sure we do, right over here. She walked over and grabbed one for me. So, But I learned a lesson twice. Those things are little lethal daggers is what they are.
Yes.
There is a point on one end, and then there's this rough, like, crude saw file thing on the other, which is what pulls the threads through. And you want to be careful with that sucker, because that pointed end, boy, if you stepped or sat on that thing, man, ooh, that would go deep and quickly. But I was an idiot. I have no idea what compelled me. But I had a thread in the sampler, which is 40 count linen. I had a thread that I just wasn't happy with, so I took the Snag Nabbit and put the pointed end in and pulled it through. And I wasn't even thinking. And that snag nabbit is too big for the hole. It's too big for that fine linen. And I am extremely lucky I didn't do damage.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad that ended better than I expected it to.
Yeah, I was. It was like I pulled it through. Why did you just do that? That was stupid. On a live stitching area, on a sampler, that was really stupid. Next, if anybody buys one, test it on something you don't care about, because I'm really lucky. And then it was the day after I did that that Teresa from Texas posted on our website about the snag nabbit and said that she had done the same thing and actually tore a hole in her linen. And she posted for me to be careful a day late, but what did she know? So, you know, fair warning for that. Be careful with those things because a valuable tool and obviously a lot of pluses, but on really fine fabric, ooh, man, like a saw right through it. So,
Same thing with seam rippers. You know, they're a great tool to use, but you have to remember to keep the pointed end up, you know, tilted. That angle is critical because as soon as you forget or get lazy and you dig down and the pointed end is going towards your fabric, it's all over.
Yep. Oh, and I did get the Vana approved seam ripper with the rubberized ends. And
yes,
that's very nice. Very nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Very nice. So yeah, it was 40% off Joanne's coupon in hand and I went in and bought stuff.
That's the way to do.
And they tell me that coming up, this is Super Bowl weekend, they tell me that watch for your coupons at Joanne's on Super Bowl weekend that some nice savings can be had. I guess the assumption that women don't go to watch Super Bowl, so they're out roaming around shopping.
At Joanne's,
which is probably closed when the Super Bowl's being played, because that now, it used to start in the afternoon. Yeah, on Sunday night.
I guess in the evening. 5:30, yeah, perhaps. 5:30.
So it's kind of silly, but I don't care. But anyway, I'm watching my coupons because
a
couple things in mind for this weekend. I might just be over there saving some money, which is.
Yeah, I have to pick up some silk fabric. I think I have a little tiny project in mind that I think I might like to try to do. So I need some silk ground cloth to work on. So.
Well. They say this is the weekend. I have no experience, just listening to the people. Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's my two stitching things. That's all I had was I almost ruined my linen. And, Nicola was, and I was talking, we were talking about the fact that my Millennium frame, the sides, I got longer than is normal and really shouldn't have. I think I'm going to have to order short ones because I took the linen off, the sampler off, and tried to put it back on, and I still can't get it so that the extensions don't go as far as I'm having to take them. But I did, in doing that, I did get a better mount with one end, so I'm getting an even more drum-tight, even linen to stitch on. So it was a plus in that regard, but I still am having to extend it further than I think I should. So I think I need to order those shorter side pieces. Should have listened to Nicola right out of the gate, but, you know, I got creative.
And what was the difference? So how did you wrap it differently this time that you think was the improvement?
I put it further into the top scroll bar. So there's a little bit, coming out the other side. And I got, for some reason, it just went in better and locked in better and is more even all the way across. So, you know, the old practice makes perfect thing, but
So
now that thing, it is absolutely dead drum tight right in the middle, which is where it was a little saggy before. So I'm pleased with that, but I'm going to have to get shorter sides because stitching upside down, while it's all quite doable and you really don't think about it, I'd rather stitch right side up. So,
Now, let me ask you a question though. So this is connected top and bottom. Is there any connection from the side? So do you feel like you need to pull to the side at all?
No, not at all. Mm-mm. No, it's drum tight all the way across. Yep.
Okay.
Not a problem. Mm-mm. Nope. Happy as a clam with it. Really, really good. Yep. So, yeah, so anyway, what came out of that is I need to order sides, which will probably take 6 months to get. But then also I just got a better mount this time, so I'm happier about that. Yay.
Excellent.
Yep. So working around the paying job, have you been able to do any stitching?
Yeah, and I kind of bounce back and forth between different things. I've been working on this Cruel pillow for a while, so I popped back in on that a little bit. I was working on that cross stitch piece, and we've talked a little bit about that, where that was the piece where it's a cross stitch piece with an outline, a black stitch back stitch outline.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then someone had written in and pointed out that I guess in European style of things, it's very common for the cross stitches to bleed out underneath the outline. That's just the way it's done there. Oh. So I wasn't doing it incorrectly. That's just how the designs are done. So that's great. And one of the things that was an issue was that it's easy to do. So if you can imagine, if you're stitching a full cross and if the outline is going diagonally from one side to the other, you have a full triangle of the cross hanging outside the outline, right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Follow so far? Okay. So for that, it's easy to correct for, right? Because you just stitch half of a stitch diagonally. Now, what's difficult is if your outline is, if you imagine, one over and two up. Now, to stitch inside that, it's not an even, you know, just the diagonal, is it? So you have to do all these weird little compensating stitches to try to fill in. So you sort of have to decide whether or not you're going to. And what I'm finding is that for me, it depends on the color of the thread. If it's a dark thread because it's a white cloth underneath, I may try to do something to kind of fill it in just so it doesn't look really sort of jagged.
Yeah.
But if it's light, it doesn't matter because you barely can see it anyway. So I don't bother to do that. But truly night and day between making the corrections and not making the corrections.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to know that that's basically how it is intended to be stitched. So
yeah,
I don't know why.
Yeah, it seems strange. Regardless, seems strange. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, why would you do that?
Right.
I do not know. That's how it is. So I wasn't misreading it. That's truly how it is intended to be stitched. So, and that's fine. And I'm just going to choose not to do that. So, yeah. So I bounced back to this Cruel project and I like it because this one just has a million different types of stitches in it. So it's got a little bit of wool, a bunch of different variegated cottons. It's big, it's heavy, it's kind of chunky, but it's a lot of different types of stitches. So I'm learning, none of them are difficult stitches by any stretch. Probably bullion knots are the hardest thing to do. And once you kind of get the hang of those, you know, once you do one well, the rest of them sort of follow. So the rest of the stitches, nothing's really difficult, but it's like do an Amazon stitch. And so you learn to do leaves that way or doing different types of chain stitches for stems and flowers because there's lots of flowers and stuff. And then there's a rabbit that's sort of, I wouldn't call it needle painted because it's in wool. So it's needle painted if you were using the biggest paintbrush ever because it's after doing it in needle painting in silk to do it in wool feels very rustic, I guess is the word, mm-hmm. right? Because you see every single stitch. But it's fun because it's, you know, learning all different kinds of stitches through this one piece. So that's kind of what I'm doing. And I have in mind a couple of things that I want to do. Once I finish that cross stitch piece, I want to start one of the samplers, but then I also want to get back into the needle painting. And I have a couple of ideas of what I want to do. This one piece, I have an idea of something that I would like to do on a navy blue silk. So that's going to require me to learn how to transfer a pattern from, you know, onto a dark colored fabric.
Yeah.
So right. That will be new. And then I'm going to be sketching from a photograph of a piece of tile, actually. It was a design that I kind of liked. So that's in the queue of things to do. And that's pretty much it. I mean, that's kind of a lot. I think I have, I have three or four. But what's nice about it is they're all very different types of pieces. So it's kind of whatever mood I'm in at the moment. You know, whatever kind of suits the need at the time.
That's the fun of it. Yep.
It is. And like with this big cross stitch piece, it's gigantic. And so I do it for a while when I sort of need a mental health break. And then I finally get sick of it and I put it down for a while and do something else. So, but I'm looking forward to getting back to the silk surface embroidery. Because I really enjoyed doing that, and I'm looking forward to maybe trying to get a little better at it.
Yeah, you brought up, as you were mentioning all of those things, you brought up something. Somebody posted somewhere here in the last couple of weeks that they had a bunch of stash and at the time did not have a lot of money to go spend on buying charts and so on and so forth. And I'm not sure what the actual question was, but the gist of it was, I've got threads and nothing to do with them. And somebody mentioned it, but I didn't feel like it got explored enough. There are an awful lot of free charts that designers put out all over the place. You know, they're not gigantic. You know, they're little 4, 5, 6 inch pieces. But if you want to just stitch, and even if you can afford charts, I collect them. Anytime I see one, I just collect it they're downloadable PDFs, so you're not stacking up paper. Mm-hmm. And I just keep them in my iPad. I use Goodreader to read PDFs. And I just keep them there. And I've got a whole collection of these little 4, 5, 6 inch designs that have been offered. And also, I don't collect these, but there's also a ton of free cross-stitch designs that designers, they'll just put something out every now and then. Just a little idea they had, and I'm sure they didn't know what else to do with it, so they'll make it available. But there are a lot of them. If you follow designers, their blogs or whatever, you'll pick up a nice collection. And what I'm going to do, I bought a tray, just a small tray, not too long ago, that has, I think, a 5-inch opening. And so these free ones that I've gotten through the years, I'm going to haul all those out, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to find 4 or 5, probably just 4, that would make good seasonal designs, either through color or because of their subject matter. And then I'm going to stitch those so that, and then Margaret can switch them in this little wooden tray with each season or with a holiday or something. And other than the cost of the tray, I'll just do it all from stash. And these free charts and have a nice series of little things that, because, you know, if you get a four inch design, you can just tack on something on the sides and make it fill 5 inches without any trouble at all. So, So I thought, you know, that was one way to use it. But yeah, there's a lot of free ones. One of my favorite free ones is Debbie Rowley at Debbie's Designs. I think it's still there, that if you just get on her mailing list, there's one you can download for free that I think is really beautiful. And I stitched that and put it in a jewelry box, a wooden jewelry box for our daughter-in-law. And it just worked out beautifully. And it's a nice little challenge, some nice colors, and easily adapted to other colors. And all you have to do is just get on Debbie's mailing list and you can have it. So there's just an awful lot of that if you just look around. And like I say, I just collect them.
Pinterest is good for that, or just Google, you know, free cross stitch pattern, whatever. There's loads and loads of them. But so for stashes, if you don't have, I mean, fabric you can get pretty inexpensively, especially we're talking about Joanne's coupons and things. One of the things that I've been running into is that okay, so you stitch a piece, now what do you do with it, right? So one of the bigger expenses is framing, right? Framing or finishing maybe, well, even finishing is going to be expensive depending on what the thing is that you're finishing. But framing is not cheap. And then if you wanted to put it into a box or something, if you price out a box that's made specifically for needlework, like to put the needlework in the lid or something like that, they're not cheap, those things. So one of the things that I kind of wanted to do is there are lots of little thrift stores around where I live. And I'm wondering if there aren't a lot of things like jewelry boxes or trays or old like little sort of curio boxes that people would put things in, or upholstered boxes, things like that, that are just sitting there that are probably a few dollars because nobody knows what to do with them because the upholstery of them is old and pretty much shot, that those couldn't be brought back to life for very little money.
Right.
You know, yeah. So that's going to be sort of my new thing. And the other thing is frames. If you go to thrift stores and things like that, there are dozens of the worst artwork ever, you know, like these terrible paintings and things like that. But the frames are okay. So you could pop the frames out, you know, take the artwork and I don't know, do something with it. Honor it in some way because somebody painted it.
Sure.
And then, but you know, frames are not always inexpensive. So, you know, and especially you may be able to find something that's a really nice, you know, quality frame for very inexpensive because it's just got some piece of artwork in it that, you know, really shouldn't hang anywhere. And then you don't need the glass because you're not going to put glass over it. So that might be a place to get, you know, decent frames for things. And you know, a little bit, you're sort of stuck with the luck of the draw as far as size and things like that. But it's worth sort of perusing those places. And when you see a frame that looks nice, it's something that you like, picking it up. You know, if it's $2-3, that's certainly worth, you know, the purchase.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, clean it up a little bit and see if you can get it to work. And then it's just a matter of blocking the piece and learning how to stretch it and, you know, lace it in the back and then frame it up. Yep. So that's one thing I think I'm going to explore. Yeah. Just as a means of cost control, because you know, otherwise you end up with all these pieces and then, you know, if you can't afford to frame them up, it's kind of sad, right? Because then what's the point? You have all these nice things that you've made and then nobody ever sees them because they're sitting rolled up somewhere.
Yeah. Reproduction sampler in an older distressed frame. Yeah. Be a nice fit.
Right. It'd be kind of cool.
Yep. So there you go. Hit the thrift stores.
Yeah. It's worth a try. I mean, it could be the worst idea ever, but I don't know.
I doubt that. I don't have the patience. I don't have the patience to go poking around in stores like that. But I'm confident without much effort at all, you're going to come up with some, like you said, little curio boxes or whatever that you can mount needlework in. And save some money. Right? Yep. Right. Well, and that's just it. You get something like that and decide, all right, I'm going to learn to lace up a piece of needlework. And you lace it up and pop it into one of those things. And if it looks okay, fine. If it doesn't, at least you're not out a bunch of money. You're out a few bucks and some effort, and you learn something. And that's
right, and you haven't ruined the piece. Then you just take it to, you know, if you need to, then you take it to a frame shop and say, yeah, so I was terrible at this. Can you please do it well?
Take it to someone with a clue, yes.
Right, and then you really haven't lost anything. What have you lost? $2 and some time.
Right.
You know, no big deal.
Nicola wrote somewhere, she put up a picture of a piece that she had laced. And that, of course, initiated a discussion about how to mount needlework, and someone had talked about pins, stainless steel pins, and I know a lot of people use those. They'll stick pins in foam core on the edges and use that as a mounting device to hold it And I guess it does work. But Nicola pointed out that where she lives in Cornwall, right there by the ocean, that everything
very
rusts.
Humid. Yeah.
You know, and so she can't put metal anywhere near her needlework because it'll rust. So she has to lace it. And so that I immediately thought of all the people along the coasts, anywhere in the world. And yeah, you have to be careful. You can't put metal in and then cover it up because it'll rust. So, yep. Even if it's stainless steel. Yep. We got to call it right here.
We do.
That's it. Sunday, we have Jenny Huff. And Jenny Huff, for those who don't know, is the teacher, the math teacher out in California, who has a whole collection of kids in a high school doing needlework as a after-school activity. So we're going to talk to her about how that got started and how it's going these days, and it's going to be an interesting conversation. So that'll be Sunday, and the two of us will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Take care.